All told, we've got about 3,000 beds now that we have lined up and identified in the short term, part of the 20,000 the state will be responsible for identifying. Roughly 17,000, I don't mean to throw too many numbers, confuse folks, but 17,000 we need to start stacking in terms of resources throughout the state of California. And that's where we're identifying convention facilities, fairgrounds. We're identifying specific assets throughout the state, including motels and hotels. Again, not just for homeless, but potentially to provide capacity.
Governor Gavin Newsom last night essentially saying California would be short about 17,000 hospital beds to deal with the expected wave of coronavirus cases. Meanwhile, on the other side of the country, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo issued this dire warning today.
New York is the canary in the coal mine. New York is going first. We have the highest and the fastest rate of infection. What happens to New York is going to wind up happening to California and Washington State and Illinois. It's just a matter of time.
New York, he noted, has 10 times the cases as California has right now and not nearly enough beds or ventilators. We're going to talk about all this with Thomas Fuller. He wrote about how and why California is struggling to prepare for a wave of coronavirus cases. He's with the New York Times and he's the paper's San Francisco bureau chief. Hi, Thomas.
Hi.
Well, the governor of California said that California is short about 17,000 beds, and so he upped that. It was 10,000 he was estimating. What else did he say in terms of shortages?
You know, I thought you could really hear the urgency and the alarm, both in his voice and Governor Cuomo's voice. I think both of these men are seeing data that they're very concerned about. You know, you mentioned the 17,000 beds, but the overall calculation, when, you know, he always shows us his math, the overall calculation was for 50,000, you know, a shortfall of 50,000. And he was hoping that the hospitals could make up a large part of that. But I thought it was very striking when he said that it was 50,000 beds according to the calculations that take into account all of the isolation that we're doing. So, and of course, there are also the numbers of, you know, the procurement numbers, how much California was going to need in terms of, you know, masks and gloves. He said 1 billion gloves, you know, and I think the quote from him was, you know, that's not a typo.
That we need or that we're short?
1 billion gloves that the state has put in an order for. He has signed an order to go procure 1 billion gloves. So it's a shortage for a number of weeks or months, but it's just a number that's hard to wrap your head around. And then it was hundreds of millions of protective kits that would include, you know, the gown and the N95 mask.
And where is he going to get all that stuff?
Well, you know, I think that speaks to California's advantages in this. California, and Newsom pointed this out, I thought very sensitively, has economies of scale. They can place huge orders and they can really nudge other smaller states out of the bidding. California is sending 6 charter planes to China to get some of these supplies directly. So I thought Newsom was sensitive because he said we need. He also issued a plea to the federal government and said, "Watch out! California is on the market for these things, and we are going to crowd out other smaller states. So we should have a centralized federal ordering system that would alleviate the pain, the worst pain in terms of procuring these things that other smaller states might suffer."
Mm. I want to also get you to comment on the fact that California is home to the world's most inventive technology companies. And I guess I'm wondering where they are in all of this. What are they doing to try to help either come up with testing solutions or come up with gear or trace the spread of this disease from, you know, an AI perspective or whatever fancy technology they have? How are they helping in this?
Well, you know, and Newsom's also mentioned the daily conversations he has with Tim Cook of Apple, with Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook, with Elon Musk. Those three people all helped contribute to around 2 million face masks. And then Elon Musk seemed to have procured overnight 1,000 ventilators. And so the governor is constantly talking about these relationships and how they benefit. Now, that said, you were talking about the comparison between New York and California. There is one very stark difference, and I don't think it's been very well explained. I think, you know, Newsom was asked about this, and he didn't quite tell us why the testing in California remains much lower and at a much slower pace than in New York. As of this week, we had 26,000 tests, probably up to, you know, somewhere around 28,000 tests now in California. And New York is up to 91,000 tests. And New York is half the size, New York State is half the size of California. So something is going right in New York on the testing front that hasn't quite clicked.
Right. And so if you have Governor Cuomo saying New York is the canary in the coal mine, and New York State has 10 times the amount of cases right now as California has, and you have California not testing as robustly as New York, those two facts really add up to California potentially seeing a big increase.
You know, I think there's so many questions. We had a story yesterday that talked about density, and let's all pray that California, which is obviously less dense than, you know, Manhattan, is going to benefit from that. But I think it's, we just don't know, because the testing here has been so slow to start up. Mm-hmm. We just don't have a good picture, and there's a lot of frustration about that.
Yeah. Well, Cuomo said the apex of the disease, he expects it in New York State to be in 14 days from now. I guess California doesn't have any kind of estimate like that.
I thought when Newsom came to the podium yesterday and suddenly gave us a much more severe picture of the shortages of equipment that we were going to have in California, that something triggered that recalculation. He hasn't told us what the model exactly looked like, what the change in the model was. But it seemed clear that some kind of data that he's seeing is pointing to something that he's a lot more worried about.
Thomas Fuller is the San Francisco Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Thomas, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, here in L.A., nurses from Kaiser Permanente Los Angeles Medical Center staged a protest in front of their hospital yesterday over a lack of protective gear there.
We are here to expose the lack of preparedness and concern for our well-being in this facility. Nurses across this country are reporting deficiencies throughout their facilities. Inside the building behind us here, we are not receiving proper staffing. We're not receiving personal protective equipment, appropriate or adequate education needed, and we have no quality communication from our employer.
Well, it's not just Kaiser. Around the world, healthcare providers are concerned about protecting themselves and their patients as they battle COVID-19. Some have been making masks out of random things they have on hand, such as plastic bags or bandanas. Joining us from Ronald Reagan UCLA Medical Center is Marcia Santini. She's an emergency room nurse. Welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, are masks your biggest concern?
Yes. Overall, protection in general. The nurses in the ER are feeling a little nervous right now. Our management has been working with us closely and trying to provide us with the correct PPE. However, we are following the CDC guidelines, and the CDC guidelines were rolled back to a lesser level of protection, which is what's concerning us. And mm-hmm. we feel that they've made this decision based on the lack of supplies And that is not how this should be handled. We need to follow our union, our California Nurses Association, has done extensive research. We have an industrial hygienist that has done the research. We also work in a state that has the highest level of protective government body called Cal OSHA, and their recommendation is that anytime there is a novel pathogen, that we must have the highest level of protection. It's actually a warning, and it says that non-respirator face masks do not protect persons from airborne infectious disease and cannot be relied upon for novel pathogens. And that's what our nurses need. They need to have the N95 masks on all day.
And how often would you use an N95 mask? How often do they need to be switched out, or can you use the same one over and over again?
No. Anytime you go into a patient's room, whatever you have on must be removed when you come out.
That would be the gloves, that would be the face mask, the goggles.
Net, whatever you have on, that is what that you are utilizing to protect the patient from you and to protect yourself from them, needs to be removed.
So what are nurses doing? Because as we've been reporting, there is a huge shortage in all of this gear, not just the masks, but everything, the gloves included. What are you doing to prepare for this?
Again, our hospital administration, our department administration is really trying to spread the message, and we need to be cognizant of it too, right? Everybody needs to be very diligent about what they're using, why they're using it, in order to preserve the supply. And so what we're trying to teach the nurses is, or our staff, is think about what you're doing, where you're going. Do you really need to have that on in the area that you're working? Now, in the emergency room, it's a bit of a challenge because, again, you don't know now who has it and who doesn't. And we're unfortunately in a situation because we didn't do mass testing in our country at a point where we just have to believe that everybody has this, whether you're a carrier or you're not, because we have been in situations where we let our guard down because someone came in for a different reason. It's not your typical cough, cold, sore throat, and you weren't dressed appropriately. We're still not wearing full protection, right? You have a simple face mask on. What we are directed to wear right now, the bare minimum, is a simple face mask and goggles. Now, if you get a cardiac arrest that comes in and you're running into the room, you don't have time to put on everything. And back when we didn't have access to everything, we have taken care of patients who have 2 days later tested positive. And now
for the coronavirus.
Right. So now we have staff that are on a 2 week either isolated because either they converted positive or if they were exposed. So there's high risk exposure and there's low risk exposure. So a cardiac arrest, when you're intubating somebody, when you're suctioning somebody, if you're doing nebulizer treatments, if say a pulmonologist came down and had to do a bronchoscopy to look into the lungs, anything that's going to produce fine particulate particles, that's, you know, like the really small, fine secretions that could float in the air, you need to have the highest level of protection. Your hair should be covered, your face should be covered, your eyes, your mouth, your gown on, gloves on, everything should be covered. And so that's a high risk.
Yeah, that sounds really alarming. So I have heard of nurses coming in with their own gear. They're making their own cloth masks to put over their N95 masks, or they're bringing in swim goggles that they have at home. Are you seeing that too?
I'm hearing about it a lot. I'm hearing it on social media. I'm hearing about other facilities. That is definitely not safe practice. We need to have the highest level of protection. And our national administrators, our president, they need to make sure that we are manufacturing this, getting it out to the staff. We have had so many generous people donate. Elon Musk just delivered pallets of supplies for us. And it's a shame that our own government isn't working diligently. They say they are, but we're already, what, into week 8, week 7?
Mm-hmm.
And we haven't seen anything. And so that's increasing the stress level of everyone, from the CNO of our hospital to the medical directors down to the housekeepers. We're all very anxious. And so...
Are you scared for yourself, for your own personal safety?
No, I'm not afraid for me. If I know I'm protected, I'm not afraid. If I'm not protected, yes, I'm afraid. I'm afraid that I'm going to infect my patients, my coworkers, bring it home to my family. That's what scares me.
Well, it's possible you won't be protected if there's not enough gear.
Exactly. And that's why we need our president to stop with the idea of returning to a normal life in the next 2 weeks. We need to be diligent. Every citizen has to stop gathering. I went to Trader Joe's the other night, and I was shocked at how many people were in a tight, compact area. If we don't do this right, it's all for nothing. We're going to just keep infecting one another. And we need to keep this curve as flat as we can. And I know we keep talking about I don't know if people are grasping that concept. If everybody gets sick at once, it's just like the grocery stores. We're all going to the store at the same time, buying the same thing, and the shelves are empty, right? We have nothing. Well, apply that to the hospital. If we're all sick at once and everybody's running into the hospital, there's only so much real estate. There's only so many pieces of equipment. We will not be able to handle the influx if we don't follow the rules.
And there are only so many nurses.
Oh, exactly. And once we start getting sick and dropping off, who's going to replace us?
Well, best of luck to you. I really hope you stay safe and that you are able to do your job.
Thank you.
Marcia Santini is an emergency room nurse at Ronald Reagan UCLA Medical Center. Coming up, how coronavirus is revealing stark differences in public schools. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Governor Gavin Newsom made an unprecedented announcement last week when he said...
I would plan and assume that it's unlikely that many of these schools, few if any, will open before the summer break.
Most schools in California will not be reopening this school year, meaning teaching until then will happen remotely, if at all. Today we have two teachers from two very different Southern California neighborhoods to talk about how they're adapting. Edward St. George teaches social studies at Animo Jefferson Charter Middle School in South LA. Welcome to you.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And Jill Fink teaches first graders at Woodlake Elementary in Woodland Hills. Hi, Jill.
Hi.
Okay, so I just want to get both of your reactions to what we just heard from the governor. When you first heard him say that last week, what went through your minds? Let's start with you, Jill.
I was preparing for it mentally. It's strange, but we're ready to go, and we're connecting with the kids, and we're going to make this work.
So far as you know, LAUSD, which you're a part of, will be back May 1st, but that
that's what we've been told. We're meeting with the whole staff, and we're going to be planning what our next step is.
Okay. And Edward, what about you?
For us right now, we're kind of just in a holding pattern. We had the 2-week break with LAUSD, and then we have a 2-week spring break. And as of right now, I haven't really heard much in regards to when we will be going back, but I'm not super hopeful.
Right. So in the meantime, what have you been doing? It's been a little more than a week for LAUSD students to be out. And Edward, what have you been doing with your students?
Well, for me, it's really hard. I serve a very low income neighborhood and community. And so for us, we don't have a one-to-one student laptop ratio. So not all of our students have access to devices. And I would say most of our students probably don't have access to internet connectivity at home. So for us, it hasn't been a normal break in compared to other schools that do have these connectivity and the one-to-one laptop ratio. But we've been working with our students. We gave them books to read. They also have online software. So the ones who do have access to devices and to connectivity are able to get online. And today I checked one of our math programs called iReady. And last week I had some students who spent 9 hours on the program working on it. So even though they're not required to be doing any work right now other than the reading, the desire is still there.
Yeah. You gave them books to read before they left?
Yeah. So I guess the Charter Network was preparing for this. So
your school's a charter school, just to clarify.
Okay. We got an email the Thursday before the closures on Friday, just saying make sure that all students have a novel to read, a book. So my last period of the day, I made them all read my library, my classroom library, and did the kind of book checks just to make sure that they had something. But again, being on such short notice with these closures, that seemed to be the only thing that we were able to do.
And how are you in contact with them, your students?
I personally have just been in contact with a couple of parents through email and messaging. But other than that, I have not been in contact with my students just because, again, we are kind of in that holding pattern and we were told just to be closed. I do have plans to post some work on my Google Classroom. All my students use it. I got lucky. I have a computer cart in my classroom. So all my students are familiar with that program. But as of right now, I haven't had really any contact other than parents reaching out.
And Jill, what about you? You teach first grade, so your students' needs are a little bit different. How are you in contact with them and how are you teaching them?
Our school community, our principal, gave us a quick hour before we were alerted that we were going to be off to plan with our grade level, and we all uploaded materials for 2 weeks on our major website, and we uploaded actually like an 80-page packet and then instructional materials to start, and then each teacher individually, we're on Remind with the parents and email. So I've been reminding and emailing every day our additional. We went on ReadWorks. Scholastic is another one. We have Go Noodle for PE. And Science, we have Mystery Science that we gave them as well. And then from there, we were reminding and texting and encouraging every day, you know, what are you doing? How are things going? Kind of checking online to see what was working. But then I was like, who needs help and who can I do a grab and go with if they don't have the materials? Because our community, yes, we mainly have access to devices, but not all. And there are different types of economic brackets and situations within our community. So trying to reach out to those different needs. And out of 24 now, I've reached out to 20 and I have three more. Today I'm going to do one more grab and go, and then I have two more that are trying to Zoom with me. And that was the next thing. My one colleague went on Zoom, and I'm a really interactive teacher, but I'm not really tech savvy, but I'm learning to be. Anyways, I thought, Zoom, I love, I'm interactive, connective, I'm going to Zoom. So she taught me how to Zoom, and then I've been going a little Zoom crazy, but it's going to take time, and it's taking some time to get everybody included and on the same page.
Right. And so there seems to be a stark difference between your experiences. Edward, when you hear what Jill said about all the technology that she's using and the Zoom and the grab and go and all that stuff, how do you react to that?
I think it's great. I think it's wonderful that all these teachers are really trying to put in this extra mile to make sure that their students are still learning and are still accessing the material. And to hear everything that their school is doing and everything that she's doing, it's wonderful. It's something that I wish that we were able to do in our community. We are still working on getting Chromebooks. I know that my charter has been working on purchasing Chromebooks, and I saw that LAUSD was able to reach a deal with Verizon for free home access for these students. So people are making the effort, and I just think in such crazy times like this, it really shows, and people are trying their best, and I think that's just what our school is trying to do. We're just trying to do our best with the limited resources that we have.
How can officials help you more? What more should they be doing, either on the city or the state level?
I mean, I'm just a teacher. I don't know if I'm fully qualified to answer that question. For me, I would love to see just more support for these low-income areas to access to basic needs like food and healthcare and even internet access, which is starting to become more and more necessary, especially with the lockdown. So just providing that social support, I think, is hugely, hugely important, especially with these areas that have been traditionally underserved.
And Jill, what about you? What would you like to see from officials?
In our community, I think it's just going to be the thing we'd like to see in terms of support is, yeah, definitely handing out tech devices to people that need them, more books if there's people that don't have home libraries, and also just a clarity of now how this is going to work in terms of, like one little first grader said on Zoom, she said, "Will I graduate first grade?" So the support of knowing what parents, you know, are they going to graduate and what they will need to do and how we will help everybody get to a place, you know, that they feel comfortable with that. But also, I think we're all making sure that the mental health is also first here, that kids feel calm and supported. All the kids that I see on Zoom, they have their stuffed animals with them. I mean, I'm working with the young children, and you know, this can, for everyone, there's an anxiety level, but just anything, any help from mental health professionals, any calming techniques, the Go Noodle for exercise, really letting parents know that their studies are important, but the way LAUSD has been going and the way I hope they continue to go is a whole person, that even, you know, now especially when anxiety is high and circumstances are uncertain, that we keep giving children tools to help them become an amazing whole person, not just I do reading, math, but you know what I mean? I think, and just let the world know, that this community know, that teachers work hard. We, like Edward, I mean, you hear the passion in our voices, and that he, what he said about students, that's so exciting. Like, students are showing me that they care about learning, and it's so nice to see that we really have good people out there, too, that want to do good.
Yeah. Jill Fink, elementary school teacher from Woodland Hills, Edward St. George, middle school teacher in South LA. Thank you both so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Coming up, a mobile laundry truck for the homeless.
And now it's obviously, like, really critical that we're there. Life and death, frankly. So it feels like a, you know, at least a positive thing in all of this.
Jody Dolan is bringing her truck to LA's new homeless shelter. She's also turning her clothing factory into a mask-making factory for corner store workers. That interview next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, LA is creating temporary shelters for the homeless. About 40 are in the works. They're mainly in city-owned rec centers. The city will also keep winter shelters open longer. They were supposed to close down this month, at the end of this month. At these shelters, the new ones, the homeless will have beds all 6 feet apart, food and access to showers, also on site, laundry service. We're going to talk now with someone who runs a laundry truck. Her name is Jody Dolan, and her truck is called Laundry Truck LA. And Jody joins me now. Hi, Jody.
Hi.
Tell us about your truck before all of this happened. What were you doing?
Well, just to back up for a quick second, I have a clothing brand, Dolan, and being in business in LA for 15 years, we just realized there was this big problem all around us and we wanted to do something about it. So we discovered this need for laundry around this community. And basically, we built a 16-foot trailer a year ago. It goes out, does laundry 7 days a week. And we just basically do as much free laundry as we can for, you know, as many people as we can serve. And now the city has asked us to, you know, ramp up the services so that we can be supporting these additional 6,000 beds that they have committed to because of the coronavirus.
And you have just the one trailer, the 16-foot trailer.
Yeah. We know that we probably will scale it. We wanted to spend a year figuring out how to do it because it's not a very common thing. And I think we're one of the few people in the world that are doing it for the homeless. So there wasn't a lot to go off of. So we spent last year, our first year doing it. And we're working on fundraising for our second. But yes, it's five washers and dryers. And in a five-hour shift, we're doing about 30 to 40 loads, depending on how big the things are. You know, if it's a big jacket or a big blanket, how big the loads are.
Right. So previously you would park it in different sites on every day and people could just come with their laundry and do their laundry for free.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's how it works.
It's pretty simple. I mean, we do need, we go to the same spot. So every Monday, you know, we'll be at MacArthur Park, or every Friday night we'll be at Safe Parking. So we do have the consistency of a location so that people know we're there and they can count on us. And we can also show up with additional services like outreach workers and caseworkers and showers and all the additional auxiliary services are usually surrounding the laundry. But yeah, otherwise it's very simple. We just show up and we do their laundry.
But now, how are you going to show up at those sites and also go to the temporary sites?
We have a bigger capacity. We can do it in shifts. Right now we're doing daytime and nighttime shifts. So our plan really is to hit as many spots as we can. So Friday nights we're at Safe Parking, like I mentioned. Sunday nights is Safe Parking. So then we have the day free. We're just working with everybody to coordinate and do as much as we can.
And you're doing this all voluntarily, right?
Yeah, this is a nonprofit. So we have been supported really by the community and by Clorox has been a partner in the city of LA and the county of LA. And my clothing brand also subsidizes a lot of the admin work that's being done too. But basically, yeah, it's all for free. It's our commitment, you know, to the community. And it's really always just been about supporting people around our office, around our headquarters, around our customers, and like just feeling like we should all be doing our part. And now it's obviously like really critical that we're there, life and death, frankly. So it feels good it feels like a, you know, at least a positive thing in all of this bad news.
Life and death because the virus can be on clothing.
Because it's really hard for this community to stay clean, right? So all of it, it's not obviously just the laundry, but it's all the resources surrounding them to make sure that they're in a clean environment and that they're able to sanitize and that they have all the things that they need and they can stay clean.
And you decided to do this because your clothing company is in that neighborhood in downtown LA.
Yeah, our headquarters are in Lincoln Heights. And so we obviously see our fair share. We're right outside of downtown. But being in this business for a long time, you know, the fashion district is right next to Skid Row and all the dye houses and the cutting services and the contractors. I mean, they're just kind of dotted all around the city. And so no matter what part of the business you're in, you know, you're part of it. It's part of the culture of the city. And so we just felt like we can do our part. And we made clothes. It felt like an obvious thing to start cleaning clothes. And, initially when we started, we hoped to inspire more people to get out and do something.
So your clothing company at the same time is also experiencing some, shall we say, economic turbulence in these times. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's minute to minute, it's not a lot of good news. We work with a lot of amazing boutiques. We have our online business, but we also work with a lot of large retailers, which are really feeling this right now. So Anthropologie and Nordstrom and Bloomingdale's, they all are closing their doors, the retail stores anyway. I should say, it's really important to say that their online business is still alive and well. But so we're trying to navigate the sea of this because it is very challenging. Nobody wants to really take in new orders for their stores. But with that,
so you're losing business. You're losing business, in other words.
Yeah, we're getting cancellations left and right. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
right. So I guess financially, it's going to be difficult for you, more difficult than it had been.
Absolutely. I think that we'll get through it. We have a really smart team and a really talented team. But for the foreseeable future, you know, we did have to let a bunch of people go last week. And I'm hoping to be able to bring them all back for the next season. But we've got to kind of see what this next few, I guess, what, days, weeks, months hold. But to keep people busy, I did bring in a crew today to start making masks.
Face masks.
Yes, not medical grade face masks, but face masks that were requested by the city to support the family-owned grocery stores and food banks. So we're donating them, and we'll see how it goes. And if there is a greater need, we would love to be part of it and to make the gowns and the masks. We have the team to do it. I think it's really about like aligning the need with the supply chain and trying to figure it out to keep people busy.
Right. And to keep other people safe who would be wearing
masks. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, most importantly, to keep people healthy and safe. Yeah. That's the priority for sure, obviously.
Well, Jody, you are an inspiration. So thank you for everything that you're doing.
Thank you.
Jody Dolan, she runs the Laundry Truck LA and is the owner of the clothing brand Dolan. Coming up, The Good Place, a conversation with the show's creator, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Tuesday, and that means it's time to talk TV.
Clear eyes, full hearts, get loose.
Oh my God, they've killed Kenny!
Three words for you. Treat, yo, so.
I am the one who knocks.
That's what she said.
And today, something you can stream from home, The Good Place, the popular NBC comedy series starring Kristen Bell and Ted Danson, is on both Netflix and Hulu. The show follows four people in the afterlife, and they all believe, in the beginning at least, that they've made it to the, quote, good place.
Hi, Eleanor. I'm Michael. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for asking. Oh, one question. Where am I? Who are you and what's going on?
Right. So, you, Eleanor Shellstrop, are dead. Your life on Earth has ended, and you are now in the next phase of your existence in the universe.
Cool. I have some questions.
Well, I spoke to the creator of the show, Mike Schur, right before the finale aired earlier this year, and here is our conversation. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
How do you feel about it ending?
Endings are hard and emotional, but I have, the way I've decided to describe it to people is I have sadness, but not regret. Like I'm sad that it's ending because it was really fun to make, but I don't regret it ending because I think it was the right time to end the show.
You explored all you wanted to explore with
Yes,
it.
We answered every question that we wanted to ask.
Like the entire meaning of life.
That's right.
Was answered.
We solved it.
Good.
If you haven't watched the show, we solved the meaning of life. So catch up. You can stream it on Netflix.
All right. So let me play a clip of Michael. It's played by Ted Danson. He's the architect of The Good Place. Mm-hmm. And here he is explaining the point system.
Hello, everyone. And welcome to your first day in the afterlife. You were all, simply put, good people. But how do we know that you were good? How are we sure? During your time on Earth, every one of your actions had a positive or a negative value. depending on how much good or bad that action put into the universe. You know how some people pull into the breakdown lane when there's traffic and they think to themselves, ah, who cares? No one's watching. We were watching. Surprise!
Is that actually a sin to pull into the breakdown lane?
It's not only a sin, in my opinion. It's like in Los Angeles, it's one of the cardinal sins, I would say. Like, and the reason that's in there, it's in the pilot, and the reason it's there is because that was the genesis of the show in many ways. I was on the 101 heading south, and it was bumper to bumper, and some guy just pulled into the right-hand breakdown lane and sped by everybody, and I did this thing that I do sometimes as I maneuver around the city, which is I thought to myself, you just lost 20 points. Like I had invented a game where when people break rules, I would imagine that this was some kind of cosmic video game and people were being assigned a point total. Mm-hmm. But this time when I did it for some reason, I thought like, maybe that's a TV show. That simple observation that, you know, you get a certain, if you get on the high score list, congratulations, eternal paradise, and everybody else, too bad, eternal torture. And that was sort of the beginning of the idea of the show for me.
But then we find out that nobody gets any good points.
Well, spoiler alert, Madeline. Come on, man.
Well, they're a pretty dim view of humanity you have.
Yeah, so as the show goes on, there's a bunch of things that happen. If you want to watch the show and learn the meaning of life, stop listening to this now. And then, you know, tune in again later. But basically you learn that the what they think is the good place is actually sort of a experiment. It's like a torture den where the people have been brought there under false pretenses, told it's the good place, but really it's a little torture cove. And then later, a couple of seasons later, you learn the point system is real. But then later you learn that the point system is so strict that no one's gotten in 500 years. And the reason that no one's gotten in 500 years, they find out, is that in the, you know, thousands of years ago, if you did something simple and kind for someone else, if you bought them flowers, you got, you know, 100 points. That's a nice thing to do. Get flowers for your friend. But in today's world, the world has gotten so complicated and the systems of commerce have gotten so complicated that now when you buy flowers for your friend, you're using a cell phone that was manufactured in factories with terrible work conditions, and your money is going to a bunch of corporations that maybe have unfair labor hiring practices and treat their employees badly. And then the, you know, flowers are shipped from Chile, and the carbon footprint of the flowers is enormous, and it's contributing to global warming. And so instead of getting 100 points in the old days for doing something simple and kind, now you're like losing 8 points. Like buying flowers for your friend, you lose 8 points. And that was a different kind of meta commentary on just what happens to the world when the world is so closed and when things are so complicated and when nothing is simple anymore and things are shipped from overseas and every action you have has about like 50 unintended consequences. So even people with the very best intentions, even people who are trying as hard as they can, you know, like every time you see this all the time, right? Someone buys an electric car or a hybrid car. And then someone else says like, you know, it's actually worse for the environment because the plants that they make those batteries in are mm-hmm. leaking this chemical and it actually, you can't dispose of them properly.
And the electricity comes from a coal-fired plant.
Exactly. And so it's actually worse. And then you go, well, what the hell am I supposed to do?
Well, right. It's a very unforgiving system of justice.
Yeah.
System.
You're talking about just the world? Yes, you're correct.
Well, of what you've said, because you cannot, there's no way to be a good person then.
Right. And so what happened on the show, which was interesting, is we ended up kind of taking a position that the important thing is that you're trying. Like being alive on Earth means you're going to fail. If you're trying to be a good person, you're going to fail. Every day you're going to fail. And sometimes you won't even know you're failing because you'll buy a salad in a store and you don't know that the lettuce was picked by a migrant farm worker who was treated terribly by the person who owned the farm. That's not your fault. You can't research every salad you buy to determine what's the best salad. Like we all have lives. We have to just do things and provide for our families and stuff like that. So,
but there is the sin of omission versus the sin of commission. So
sure.
If you don't know that something is harmful, does that excuse you?
No, that's in the world of the show, no, it doesn't. In the world of the show is this omniscient system that knows everything, including all the stuff you don't, and it punishes you for not knowing. And so that was the essential unfairness that the characters have started fighting back against. And they, in an episode that aired a couple days ago, they kind of designed a new system that takes that into account and that improves upon the existing system. And because it's a TV show, that system was adopted, and now that is the official system going forward.
Any hints as to what that system is?
Well, it was basically trying to avoid cruelty, really, in that episode, which aired, I think, 2 weeks ago. The new system is like, okay, in the old system, life on Earth was a test that you either passed or failed. End of story. And no chance for a makeup test.
Basically Christianity.
Right. It's like where sin is the primary problem, right? Mm-hmm. In the new system, your life on Earth is sort of a class that you take. You get a point total, just like you used to. But then you die and a group of sort of celestial architects design a test for you. Now your test begins once you're dead. And the test could be anything. The test could be you wake up and it looks exactly like your regular life and you don't even know you're being tested. It could be you show up and told you're in the good place, but really you know you don't belong there and you're tested that way. It could be anything. And you take this test where you're presented with a bunch of moral challenges. And at the end of the test, which could be a day long, a week, a month, a year, whatever, you're debriefed. And the architects come in and they say, here's what you did well, here's what you did badly, and then you get to take it again. And there's a sort of residue from what you learned that stays with you so that when you take it over again, there's a little voice in your head that when you're about to make a decision that you made badly the first time, it goes, maybe don't do that. And you just get to take it as many times as you want. And so the idea was, look, some people, the very worst people who ever lived, are never going to pass the test, right? They're trapped and they're in their own version of hell, you would say, because they're just in this sort of myth of Sisyphus thing where they're rolling a rock up a hill over and over again and it's going to roll back down. However, if you're a good person and you like have a soul and a conscience and you get better, then you eventually nail the test and then congratulations, you get in.
Okay, so in that world, the guy who's in speeding down the breakdown lane to get ahead of traffic, what happens to him?
So,
because let me just posit an alternate view of his morality. He's not hurting anyone. Let's say we don't know what's happening. Maybe in the back seat, his wife is in labor, or maybe his kid has been hit by a car and he's got to go quickly to the hospital. You don't know what's prompting him to do that. You're just assuming that he's operating with selfish principles.
Yes. Now, the system would know that, right? So if I was wrong, I was like, you lost 20 points, the system wouldn't have caused him to lose 20 points. The system would say, okay, it's a different situation if he's racing home to get to his sick kid or something like that. But
we are the system and we're the ones who design the moral ethics.
That the essay, the graduate address that David Foster Wallace gave at Kenyon years ago, called This Is Water, he basically argued this, right? He said, if you're in a grocery store checkout lane and a woman cuts in front of you and she's got 25 items and the 12 items or fewer aisle, your temptation is to go, God, why are you so annoying? I hate you. And he basically asked you for empathy. He asked you for blind empathy. He said, maybe she's got a sick kid at home and she's racing home. Maybe she had a really hard day. She works as a nurse, you know, in an old folks home and she had a really hard day and she just needs to get home because she has a pounding headache. He asked you to be empathetic and to give people the benefit of the doubt. And so another part of being a good person isn't just doing good things. It's also trying to be empathetic and to be other directed and to believe the best in other people. So yes, if that guy who sped into the breakdown lane was racing home to see his sick kid, he might be gaining 8 points and not losing 20. I don't know. But I don't think that was the case based on the car he was driving and the brief glimpse
so
I got.
You just lost points for being judgy.
But you know what's so funny? So Will Harper, who plays Chidi, and I did a thing in Boston on public radio in Boston, WBUR, and it was open to the public. And we were taking questions from the audience and someone said, did you ever think that you would be punished in a bad place points kind of way for being so judgmental about other people. And I was like, oh no. And it never occurred to me. And I was like,
one.
I'm absolutely being judged for that. No question.
There are so many ways to mess up.
Yeah, there sure are. Welcome to being human.
Mike Schur, creator of The Good Place. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And you can stream The Good Place on Netflix and Hulu now. And that's it for us here at Press Play. Hopefully you are in a good place. Not the good place, a good place, or at least an okay place. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.